Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me today, Mr. Brandon Searles. I feel like I butchered that again.
No, it was perfect.
I always get nervous about people's names for whatever reason. It's in my head one way, and then I say it, and I'm like, did I say that right? But
I do the same.
But so I'm thankful to have you on. Give congratulations as our recording here on your recent nuptials. So did the old married thing. So that's congrats on that, and glad.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you take time out of your wedded bliss to come talk Kenpo with me. So I just thank you so much for that. So I usually kick things off with just giving a little brief background of my history. I started in Kenpo in the 90s, and since then I have done a multitude of martial arts, being capoeira, hapkido, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, Muay Thai, boxing. So I've been pretty busy, but now I am just getting to talk to wonderful people such as yourself. So I'm going to turn it over to you and go ahead and tell me and the listeners how the martial arts found you, how Kenpo found you, and where did it all start for you?
Sure. So I grew up as a little boy hearing stories from my father of how he trained with Dan Inosanto. And my dad was a huge Bruce Lee fan, still is. And so actually named me Brandon Lee. So I'm Brandon Lee Searles, named after Bruce Lee's son.
Oh, very nice.
So there was always a bit of a influence there, right? And, you know, we would fall asleep to Bruce Lee movies and or other, you know, martial arts kind of B movies, you know, at the time. And ones that were really above my head story-wise. And then when in the mid to late 80s, a Taekwondo school finally opened where I lived with my mother in that area of Southern California, Temecula, Murrieta area. I was able to actually enroll in a school and start learning an actual martial art. And I trained in that for some time. Had my first tournament and just a lot of great experiences. It wasn't as much of a self-defense focus, so I'm not casting any disparity on Taekwondo. This particular institution was definitely more tournament-focused than it was a self-defense. So it left a little bit of a gap in the appetite, if you will. Then I ended up moving to with my mother and stepdad to another location in Flagstaff, Arizona, where I had an opportunity to start learning Qigong Kung Fu. And this was a whole new experience because the fluidity that was required was so different than, you know, the linear of movements that I had, at least, you know, at the time under my belt. And then I watched, yes, I'm one of those that one of my best friends, we went to the video store, rented this martial arts movie that looked really interesting called Perfect Weapon.
Oh, and, yes, that's how I got
watched
started.
Watched it, and after the opening, you know, scene with the snap song, I got the power. We're like, sold. And went to the phone book, looked up, you know, is there a Kenpo school here? And we found one, and we were enrolled, and that's where my Kenpo journey began. And I absolutely loved it. I was again in high school at the time, but we were training hard, really enjoying it. And then I had moved down to the valley here in Phoenix was going to school and needed to, you know, I had taken a pause in my training and re-enlisted. So I went to what was one of my Kenpo instructor's good friends that I knew of. I had met him at karate camp, and so I connected here. Now, this is before, you know, internet and whatnot, so it wasn't as easy to see, you know, correlations, and I didn't know, you know, as much about different styles. I thought I was, you know, going into Kenpo again. Turns out I was going into more of an Okinawan hard style that had some American Kenpo developed into it as well. So now I was training in Okinawan Shiri-ryu. Did this for 15 years and met some incredible people, incredible experiences. So thankful for the training that I learned there. And I did get to rank second black. And then after another, you know, pause in life training, realized that I really want to return to what was really my first love in martial arts, and that's Kenpo. And so I again found another Kenpo school that was local to me, and came in on the mat. I feel like I'm giving hopefully not too much detail here, because there was other few things that I had experienced that the politics sometimes that happen, you know, in the dojo or between styles or, you know, instructors, that almost, I was almost ready to just hang up the belt, you know, but so this is after that. We can go into that later if you like, I'm happy to share. But it was so great. And so I'm back in Kenpo. And was able to continue that journey. I take with me that which I learned in the hard style, some of the breathing, some of the stances, some of the principles. But taking those with me into Kenpo, it's I really like where I'm at.
Very nice, very nice. So to kind of run back here with your father, was your father into doing, I mean, he was obviously very into the martial arts, but was he actually practicing or anything like that?
So, great, great question. All I had was stories, again, of him training at the Kali School Center of Martial Arts in Torrance, California, again, with Dan Santo. And so I had thought he was a martial arts fan. And so when I had went into, you know, martial arts, I thought, oh, you know, he's going to be proud. This is going to be the thing. But it turns out he wasn't really a martial arts fan. He's a Bruce Lee fan, right? So what I would show, you know, in my deep stances, you know, horse stance and reverse punches and doing the forms, he would just kind of shake his head and give the, fluidity. You're not, you know, that's too formal, too, right? And I was like, it'd crush me. But I'm actually thankful for that. And I'm not meaning for this to be a sad story. I'm thankful for that because in order for me to really own my own martial journey, I needed it to be about me and not about someone else, right? Not about something external. So I had to decide in this, in that period of time, am I doing this for someone else or am I doing this for me? And I came to the conclusion that no, I'm doing this for me. And therefore, I don't need to wait for that type of affirmation per se. I'm going to chase the path that my heart really leans to. And that's honestly what I've done ever since.
Very nice, very nice. So moving over to, so you mentioned that the Taekwondo school that you started at, you know, wasn't feeding the hunger, and you moved over to the Kung Fu school. Between the Kung Fu and the Kenpo, were you also just not getting getting fulfilled in the Kung Fu school, or what was, so, I guess, what was the catalyst for Kung Fu moving to Kenpo?
Sure, absolutely. So the Kung Fu school was a, I had started to get into trouble as a young teenager. I was definitely hanging with the wrong group, and you know, working some things out from, again, parental relationships, and found myself in trouble with the law. And knew that I really needed to make a turnaround. I'm 14 years old, right? 14 or 15. And so was sitting there in a little solitary confinement cell in juvenile hall in Flagstaff with, as by design, a lot of time to think. And I was really thinking about what things make me feel good about me, what things bring out the best in me versus the things that bring out the worst in me, and recognizing that the group that I was associating with and the feelings that I was trying to protect and not let go of were not my friend, and that one of the things that made me feel the best was in training on the mats, and both from an individual standpoint and the camaraderie, you know, of with the class and the instructor dynamic. So I went searching for this again. I happened to be a friend of my stepdad's who had said he had a Qigong school. And so I started there. It was not casting disparity on this. It was more of a living room that was kind of cleared out, right, in his house for a few of us to work out, and it was good, but it wasn't really the classroom dynamic that I was looking for, and at the time, now this is from my lack of maturity, right, not their fault, had me just really working conditioning drills, so I'm kicking sandbags, right, with my shins and things, and I thought, well, this isn't what I was looking for, you know. So I ended up taking that pause there, tried some school sports, you know, and then found the Kenpo. So it wasn't necessarily that I had, you know, gave it really a fair chance.
Gotcha. So you get into Kenpo. Was this a American Kenpo school, or was it a kind of a different variation or different flavor of?
Yes. So it was definitely American Kenpo school, but I didn't know at the time. Again, I wasn't schooled on Kenpo, so I didn't know the whole lineages and so forth. You know, with Mr. Parker. So it in retrospect, now I know it was a Tracy system. So the forms were pretty much the same, but the techniques were a little bit changed in different names from a Ed Parker curriculum. So, but still definitely American Kenpo. Small world, as it turns out, my instructor was cousins with Dan and Asanto. So this gave me this little, you know, this little meant to be kind of thing. Sure. In the air.
I'm glad that your start was kind of similar to mine, at least as far as the Kenpo part, because as you were mentioning, you mentioned the perfect weapon, it made me think about kind of how I started when I was always a big fan of martial arts, saw the perfect weapon, and, you know, turned to my buddy and We got to do this. What is this thing? And I remember seeing the sign that said Kenpo Karate, and so we had to find that Kenpo school and get signed up. The school that I trained at was essentially that of the Tracy's curriculum. Wasn't a Tracy school per se, but it was kind of that curriculum. But I had this thought of something that I may want to start asking people, especially those that have got into Kenpo because of the perfect weapon, was when you started training, going off of the things in the movie, was there any kind of points where it's like, oh, well, that wasn't in the movie. So let me kind of frame this in the thought process of when I was training, one of the things that, and it even still kind of drives me crazy, and some people are probably going to get mad at me, but that's okay. Watching the initial kind of training montage, and everybody's got their belt knots pulled off to the side, and I'm sorry, I'm not a fan of that, and I didn't understand why they did that. We didn't do that at the school that I started at, and so pretty much every time I watched the Berg Weapon, it was like, move your belt, like, what? It's about the side, but
yes,
and yeah, some of the things that they were doing in the early, we didn't have blocking set and that sort of thing. Was there any kind of things that were in the movie maybe that you weren't seeing in the training, or just didn't matter? You were doing Kenpo and you were happy, or
you know, that's an interesting. It was a little bit the other way around, right? I was looking for things in the class saying, okay, now where's that in the movie, right? As if the movie was the curriculum. And so in class, there was a form, because, you know, again, being part of that is book set. And so there were some of the green belts who were doing book set, and I would look at that and I would try to, you know, find that part and then go back and try to find it in the, you know, well, where's those moves? Cause those look different, you know, in the movie. But then there's ones that we would see that we would do, like, you know, say five swords, you know, which is, you know, overlaid, in the movie and so forth. And what, you know, seeing someone do long four, although I didn't know that's what it was, right? Which is definitely in the opening parts. It's funny, if I may comment, you say about the belts. That is, it, you know, not trying to disrespect any of the listeners. Everybody has their own choices and so forth. Pulling the belts to the side drives me crazy. I have a little bit of a symmetry thing myself where I need things to be lined up, you know, even if like the centerpiece on the table is off, I have to fix it and move it. So maybe that's my own little OCD. But I felt like it was a fix for a particular use case that somehow got adopted as edict. And, we did not do that. I remember it wasn't until I was actually black belt that it was like, okay, well, you know, you're not the instructor, got to pull your knot to the side. I'm sure. Is that what's blocking our training here? Is that what's inhibiting the learning process? Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, like I said, I don't mean any disrespect to those that are very, feel that they need to do that or whatever. It's just, it's not my cup of tea. And should I have my own school one day, everybody, you get to wear your knots in the front. So we'll just, you know, just have to deal with it and and move on. So
yeah, if I may comment additionally, you know, in the different styles, there are different it's almost like cultures, you know, practices, traditions that go around the uniform, and how in showing that respect, right? In the Okinawan, at least the styles I was influenced with, the Goju-ryu, Shuri-ryu, Shurei, you did not roll your sleeves, right? That was considered disrespectful. You were in a very clear, press gi. If the master level rank was there, you did not wear a black gi. You wore a white gi to signify that you are a blank canvas, that you are there to absorb knowledge. You are not there to provide knowledge, right? There's a whole respect factor, even into the, we talk about belts, you didn't tie your belt on facing the mirror, facing the showman, facing the instructor. You turned around as a respect. You know, there's so it's like it's not just in Kenpo world, right? In the different karate do circles, there's there's different traditions. And I say, hey, as long as it means something to you and it goes with a principle that is fungible to your students and enhances the learning process, sure.
Gotcha. So I ask this of all those that have trained in other styles before they got into Kenpo. Was there a learning curve, a difficulty, breaking old habits or unlearning things, or were you able to just jump right in and get to training?
Oh, definitely. So coming from the Taekwondo school, first of all, there is a rule. You were not allowed to strike to the face, right? Even in sparring ever. So I wasn't used to head being a target, which is like one of the primary targets, right? So also when we would spar, again, this particular school, I mean, you did not make any contact. You got close, but you didn't make any contact, even though you were fully padded up, mouthpiece, everything, right? I mean, you were ready to jump out of a car, but you couldn't make contact. And if you did accidentally make contact, you had to stop, bow, and then apologize to your partner. This was an absolute 180, right? So the first night, got called up to spar, and I'm used to this, right? Even though it wasn't maybe what I wanted, I didn't know any different, and so I was used to being chastised if you broke those rules. But so he's a partner's, striking to the face and making contact, and I'm looking at the instructor like, what do I do, right? So there's definitely a learning curve there. Another bit of a cyclic learning curve, if it's interesting, is something that's somewhat unique, it seems to be, to at least American Kenpo, right, is in the bow stances, particularly like the forward bow, how you turn your toe in, right, versus some of the more Okinawan and maybe Japanese influences where your feet stay a little more on the railroad tracks, if you will, right, toes pointed forward. So I learned the bow stances. They became intrinsic. This is where I naturally go to. Then when I went into Shuri, had to unlearn that, straighten the toes out, again, 15, 17 years, then go back to Kenpo and learn to turn the toes back in. So definitely.
Oh, yeah. Once again, kind of mirroring my journey, going from Kenpo to Capoeira. Almost everything that you do in Capoeira is kind of opposite the way you do in Kenpo.
Oh, I would think so.
So that was quite a struggle. And then going from the Chinese Kenpo that I started with to the Ed Parker's American Kenpo that I do now, having to get. Well, one thing's I call leg checks, knee checks. My kryptonite. We didn't really do those in my first school, and I do a technique now, and it's like, oh, where was that leg check? It's like, okay. Yeah, so doing that has been getting me. And then at our school, we like to do techniques on both sides. So I know some people are not fans of that, but that's okay. That's their journey. And I think, even though I struggle with it, I think it is a good thing to do, whether or not it's necessary. That's, we can debate that, but, I like it. And, I think it's a good thing. It really makes that brain work. So, I'm a big fan of that. So
I would love to double click on that for a second, if you'd allow me to.
Oh, of course, of course.
Coming from myself being very dominant left-handed, I'm really dominant left-bodied. I'm left eye dominant. I'm definitely left hand dominant, left foot dominant. For all I know, I'm left ear dominant. I don't know. but I would learn them always on the right side. And it didn't necessarily feel like my power side, and I didn't have that contrast too. So until I would learn them on the left side, I wouldn't necessarily know how to compare what the power side versus your natural power side developed. And so I've become a firm believer in the symmetry. And I personally, I understand maybe whether it's curriculum requirement for sign off for rank to demonstrate on the right and left side. Sure, maybe debatable, right? Instructor to instructor, or school to school, or maybe system to system. But I personally have a bias that if we don't train them on both sides, one, we are developing an imbalance in our body. To me, no different. This may sound like an exaggeration, that if I go to the gym and I say, "Well, I'm gonna do a bench press with dumbbells, and this is my stronger side, so I'm gonna grab, you know, a 50 pounder. This is my less stronger side, so I'm gonna grab a 35 pounder." And I'm exercising this way, I'm building an imbalance. My body is adapting to an imbalance, whereas it's important that I grab the same weight so that I'm not putting these compensations in from stabilizer muscles and things that, and not to get lost in the weightlifting analogy here, right? But I'm building these, I'm building in a loophole that isn't gonna serve me. And limits me, right? So I'm absolutely for it of both sides, and I try to do so myself. I recognize, however, that the majority of the world isn't left-handed and probably isn't going to strike with their power side being the left. However, there's that imbalance. And if that happens, what do we do, right? And I know we have techniques that do respond to the left side, but all of them work, right and left. So hopefully I don't sound like I'm preaching here on that, but you happen to strike something that has been something for me all my martial journey. Even into, there was a time, again, in my immaturity that I felt like, well, what if I just learn it only on the left side because I'm left, dominant, which that wasn't the right answer. Mm-hmm. So that contributes to where I ended up today, that I say, amen, right and left side.
Yeah, I like it. Plus, my instructor, he is left-handed, and his daughter is also left-handed. And he said, "Hey, I had to learn the system on both sides, so you're going to have to do it too." So. And I was like, well, I can't argue with that. So.
Yeah.
having fun with that. So also kind of going back to something that you mentioned that struck a chord with me was the no hitting to the head from the Taekwondo school. The handful of tournaments that I was in, I'm pretty sure I got disqualified in every single one because of... contact to the head. I'm a big fan of throwing the back knuckle to the head, reverse punch to the body combination, and also at our school we love to do something that we called the California Blitz, coming in and throwing that back knuckle got me disqualified basically every time I competed. So so I can relate to that. It was like, well, we hit to the head at our sparring classes. Why is this not allowed in this tournament? But every right. tournament has their rules. So turning that to the competing side, did you do any competing in your training? Or?
Honestly, not a lot. I had competed in Barstow original with the Taekwondo. Again, that was my first competition experience in the martial arts. I had previously, as a young child, competed in wrestling. and in the school that I ended up with, the organization within Shiru, it was called ABKI, Arizona, Arizona Budokan International. I should re-say that for Ed. I'm sorry. The organization that I was in for the Okinawan hardstyle was called ABKI or Arizona Budokan International. The grandmaster of the system had a little bit of an issue due to some religious beliefs with competition per se. So would kind of skew it a little bit to where it was more like us making each other better opportunity under pressure. So it was still technically competition. There were judges, there were placing, but it maybe took some of the flash or the show out because it required you to not demonstrate, and no disrespect to any of the tournaments, but not demonstrate just how loud you could yell or look like Van Damme, right? Or acrobatics that you could do, but required you to demonstrate technique, both in self-defense techniques and in forms. It was called a shi'ai, which would more translate like a family gathering. So I did compete in those, and I give that nuance because it wasn't, again, you know, so much tournament as it was opportunity, a testing, if you will, right, within the organization. The organization was only a couple hundred people, so it wasn't as broad of a opponents, so to speak, that you would be in. I did then go to when I would return to Kempo, a tournament, and I was going to compete in forms, and I did, and it was. I know I bring with me my biases, and I own that. I've never been one that I found the joy in the competing in the ring so much as the learning and sharing of knowledge. It's just a little bit of a different flavor for me. But I competed in doing a long three, long form three, and I remember, you had to compete even though I wasn't a black belt yet in Kempo. Because I was a second black in another style, of course, I had to compete at a black belt level in that class. And so I'm just, getting ready to, and I have the shi'ai in mind of all right, we need to make this functional, show the technique, show the torque, show the little nuances, right, that a very detailed eye is going to be looking for. And the gentleman in front of me got up and did as a fourth or fifth degree, I don't recall, he did long one. And it was a modified shorter version of long one. And so we're simple basic blocks and reverse punches, right? Mm-hmm. But he yelled real loud, and he looked around in between, and added these things. And took the first, right? Mm. And so I'm not saying I'm sore about that. I'm just saying it's a different scorecard than mm-hmm. maybe my biases go for. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to continue. That being said, maybe I should open a new opportunity and enroll in a tournament and see what it has.
Gotcha. Yeah, I can relate to that. I only did sparring when I competed. I wanted to do forms, but at the time I was not a high enough belt to do the previously mentioned book set, which is one of my favorite forms. I did not have that in my toolbox yet, and I really wanted to compete with that one. So I stayed away from doing the form part of it. I've kind of toyed around with the idea of doing it now in my advanced age, but I don't know. We'll see. But I can relate with the depending on the tournament that you're at. If the judges are all soft style folks and you do something like book set or Tiger and Crane, then you're gonna take the gold. But if they're all hard style judges and you do one of those forms, then They're like, oh, well, where's those Ford bows and where's those deep horse stances? And it's like, well,
that's right.
It's not in this particular form. So, yeah, that left a bad taste in my mouth for doing a forms competition. So, and now I yep, realize exactly. you have to play to the audience, and if they're into all the extreme martial art stuff and the crazy yelling and flipping, then. I'm not the biggest fan of that, but I think that comes with age and experience. Of course, when I was starting, all of that flashy stuff was really exciting. I watch it now and I'm just like, no, that just doesn't look all that great to me.
Right, I know. It's, you know, we go back to. Perfect weapon, right? Now, this looks great in the movies. You're talking about, you know, some things we didn't see, but there's the scene where he's in the gym, and at the end, he's doing the spinning double inward crescent kicks, right? Mm-hmm. Whap, 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 whap. And that's not necessarily something that would be as practical on the street, you know, but looks great in a movie and probably a tournament.
Yeah, exactly. Very nice. All right, so let's move into the teaching side of it. When did you get involved with the teaching part of it, and was it something that you you've always been interested in doing, or were you kind of have it thrust upon you, or how did that all start?
So, it's interesting. When I started again in the Tracy Kemple and Flagstaff, a lot of the classes, the initial information was being given to my friend and I by green belts and brown belts. And there was a little bit of me at that time that felt shorted, saying, well, hey, how come I'm not learning from the black belt? What's going on here? You know, I want to learn from him. But on the other hand, we were getting very, very detailed, you know, someone who could spend the time with us, you know, show us the dynamics and so forth. Fast forward to when I'm going for starting to get to green belt in Shuri, that's when, as you worded it, got thrust into instruction, and I would get called up, you're bowing us in today, and, you know, take it. And initially, you'd feel this imposter syndrome, right? Like, who am I to... and I love that in retrospect, because I had to learn to be the authoritative voice in the class, and trusting that realizing it's in that moment, it's not just a trusting in myself, it's trusting in the learning process that I have put myself in, and learning that there's a cyclic paradigm here, right? Where every instructor should be a student. Every student works to an instructor. And old Chinese proverb, right? For every one thing we teach, we learn 10. And I learned so much about even my own art and balance and seeing it on different body types from this instruction, even if it was just doing warm-ups, even if it was just going through the Kihon Waza basics in the beginning. So that's where I developed, honestly, a love of articulating and communicating the art to others, because one, and these aren't in order of priority, but one, it develops the art in me and gives me a greater balance, greater understanding, both of the areas that really aren't compromisable and areas that are flexible. And then seeing that light bulb moment, seeing someone experience that thing that they couldn't do, and then seeing their potential their understanding of their own potential increase in front of your eyes is that's a high for me. That makes it worth it. And we all know, right? For everyone that walks in, or rather, for every 1,000 that walks in, you know, maybe a fraction of those continue. But that doesn't mean there's something wrong with it, right? But sometimes we have to maintain our morale of you know, reteaching the basics. A couple times I have started to you know, I had actually been given a charter where I could open my own school. I took on a few students and started teaching, learned some of the hard lessons, you know, of a beginning where learning to not give too much too soon, because it's not that, you know, you don't trust them, but overwhelming knowledge, giving the opportunity to really drill in the basics before you get to some of the more advanced applications. However, maintaining that trust that I know this feels monotonous. I know this feels like, you know, you don't always see exactly how this is, you know, we're doing it big, we're doing it strong, how it feels applicable in outside of the ideal phase, but to trust that we're going to build upon this. We're going to build upon this, right? The foundation makes sense to the wall. And so that's been my experience. And now with having an opportunity, in fact, it being in, done a virtual seminar with my wife, that was such an incredible honor. Had its a new level of instruction, learning, and challenges, because you have a virtual audience. You don't have that initial feedback, right, where you can see, is the information being understood? Is it being absorbed? You know, how many people are even listening, per se, right? I think of Robin Williams, right, when he had shifted from stand-up comedy to movies, and he was asked what the big difference was. And he said, well, I used to know if I was funny that night. Going into movies, I had to wait a year and a half to find out, right? So yeah. There's that instant thing that you lose. But now we've been included, asked to be instructors at a Boston Tea Party coming up in May. Just absolutely honored. And so this is the instruction is something, not to over too much on your one question here, but it's something that I believe is absolutely necessary, both for my development, for the contribution to the art, and as I surround myself with those who have the joy of learning, right? It cultivates that atmosphere of, again, excellence, us being the best us we can be.
I like it. So moving over to cross training, are you doing any cross training now, or is it all Kenpo all the time? Or
so interesting timing that you ask. At our wedding, I had invited the instructor, first instructor that I had met at the karate camp right in high school, ended up training with for several years in Shuri, and. He is retired from teaching, no longer has a school, but has all of this knowledge, you know, and is seventh in Shuri, has multiple other ranks, and had the past also black in previous American Kenpo. And it was so good to connect with him again. And so my wife and I are going to be having him come to our dojo now and start working with him on some of the things he has to share. So being able to have that cycle, right? Kenpo, and then went to the hard style Shuri into Kenpo, and now being able to incorporate the two from a more mature, from myself here, a more mentally mature state, having him be able to work with my wife and us. It's something really, really looking forward to.
Very nice, very nice. Okay, so with the popularity of the MMA and just kind of the changes of everything in the martial arts, I've seen us, but I've seen there's a shift of getting away from I like to say the kind of the Mr. Miyagi way of martial arts and having this, I don't know, respect, grit, and seems that there's more focus now on just kind of the show and the I don't know, air arrogance. I'm curious as to what your thoughts about kind of the future of Kenpo. Where would you like to see it go? Where do you think it's going? And are there things that maybe we're not doing now that we used to do that maybe we should get back to, or just kind of your thoughts of where things are heading?
You know, I've long said that it only takes one generation, right, for the art to diminish. It's in within that we have to protect the things that are valuable. So what is valuable to us, right? What are our key principles in Kenpo? You know, you talk about with the MMA and the different styles or the different kind of some of the showy things. Think about in the book Living the Martial Way, author Forrest D. Morgan does a good job of talking about the essentially three types of people who get into the martial arts, right? One who are looking for something, a new way of getting in shape, right? A new fun kind of thing to learn. Okay, sure, great. And then they get to a certain level, but then after a certain level, depending on the school they're in, it will probably require more of them than they really want to be on a different flavor of exercise. Then you have those who are in love with self-defense, right? And really want to be able to protect themselves. And they tend to come in with the mindset of, okay, they want to go straight, skip the ideal phase, go straight to the make it work, but what if, right? And that's almost a fear-driven mindset in a sense, because you're all of your investing is in kind of an insurance policy, right? And I know I said three, it's really four. Then you have the competitive. I'm looking for another place to compete. I'm looking for another game to play, right? I'm good at games. Let's play a game. Great. And I don't mean that despairingly on those who are competitive. But there's a drive there. And then last is, of course, the historical, the meaning and the cultural relevance and the principles and the wisdom, right, that is built into understanding the Bushido, the way of the warrior, the warrior class and the philosophy and so forth. And I say there's elements of value in all of these, right? So instead of it having to be this or this or this, why can't we pull it into a full circle, right? And they're all seats, that they're all viewpoints, right, at a table. So what I say to the current Kenpo community, Kenpo is strong today, but I think a weak area, and I say this carefully, again, not meaning disrespect, a weak area is sometimes we're majoring in the minors and we forgot what it's like to learn, to love the learning process. We forgot what it's like to really embrace ourselves as a community. And instead of only being experts at what everything is wrong or why didn't you do this, why didn't you do that, let's look at what we are doing, right? Let's water the flowers that are growing. Let's build that support and that community, because that's where we find strength, right? The success that I have had in the impact of the martial arts in my life hasn't just been the self-defense. It hasn't just been the physical exercise and health for my body. It hasn't just been the instruction and the learning life cycle of knowledge, learning respect. It has also been the camaraderie, the relationships that I've built with some incredible people along the way. I wouldn't trade anything for it.
I like it. Very nice. All right. So we are going to move into our lightning round here. I've got a few little questions for you as we head towards our close here. The first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Do I have a favorite technique? The question is sometimes is what's my new favorite technique, right?
That'll work.
Unfortunately,
too.
I shouldn't say unfortunately. It's a moving target. I am not unlike many Kenpoists where I find this beauty in five swords. but currently, because some of things that I'm learning to apply, I have become, this is going to surprise some people, a big fan of snapping twig. And just loving the collapsible deflection and the energy that you're able to bring and the multi-directional aspect to it.
I like it. I like it. Yeah, that's always been one of the ones that I love, mainly because it's one of what I call a Kenpo All-Star technique. It's I was happy to see that it's both in the Chinese Kenpo version that I started with and the current version that I'm in. And it's one of those techniques like five swords, thundering hammers that seems to be in every version of Kenpo, maybe a little bit altered, but kind of the base technique of that seems to exist everywhere. So that's a good one. I like it. Right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Yeah. So I have a favorite form and a favorite set. My favorite form is, surprise, surprise, long four. And it continues to grow because it's it just, I don't know, you said lightning round, so I'll keep the answer short here. But the more I unpack, the bigger it gets. And the more I apply the principles, the smaller it gets. So it's constantly growing and shrinking at the same time. And that is art.
Very nice.
There's something about finger set two that just, I don't know, maybe it's because it reminds me of some of the Chinese influence. And then you have your ability to apply power similar to some of the Okinawan hard style. It really has... this mix, and it can have a beauty and a grace to it. It can also have some snap and some sting. So that's going to be my favorite set.
I like it. I'm actually kind of surprised. I kind of expected most people to say long four, and I'm surprised at actually how little long four is picked. I think short three is probably the one that most of the guests have said. I was also surprised that stance set gets a mention quite a bit. And I believe your lovely wife picked a stance set, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but, stance set too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and she does it with grace and elegance. I am relearning stance set too from her, and just the dynamics that she's able to articulate. And to be honest with you, it's funny, we mentioned about four, stance set two, I feel unlocked a whole new set of dynamics in long four for me.
I like it. All right, so we're going to move to the next question, which is, do you have a favorite weapon?
Do I have a favorite weapon? Yeah. So it's just kind of nostalgic, and I haven't worked with it in quite a while. I look forward to bringing it back, and it's not... you know, the most practical. It's not the thing that you have, you know, laying around in the back seat if you're attacked, but it's a pair of size. I always liked the size when we started learning with, you know, how you could, with a finger articulation. And of course, it couldn't have anything to do with how I used to like watching like American Ninja or Revenge of the Ninja.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Always a pair of size in the back there somewhere.
I was, as soon as you said size, that was the first, American Ninja was the I can see the scene right in my head. It popped right in my head where he breaks out his size, and I was like, oh, yep, right there.
Very nice. Very nice. And that's my favorite weapon to wield. But I've always been in love with the katana. But I left that out of my answer simply because the one that I look forward to practicing again is the sai.
Very nice. Very nice. I like it. I like it. All right. Next one. If there was anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
You know, that's a great question. And I would have to say, so is Dan Innocento. And that is something that, that closes a gap from a kind of a bucket list as a kid. I've actually been looking. Of course, things have been very busy, you know, with the planning a wedding and so forth. But Brittany and I have been looking at, dates where he's, you know, doing seminars and so forth. And so I'm going to make that happen. At one time, it was Jeff Speakman. I got the opportunity to train with him once, and I hope if I tell this as a short story, I hope it doesn't take too much time.
Go ahead. We got plenty of tape.
My brother was a photographer for a while, and so he would travel and do photo shoots. And so he called me one day, years and years ago. I was brown in Shuri at the time, and he said, "Hey, I've got this photo shoot. I need your help. Could you bring your gi and come? We just need to take a couple pictures. You know, I promise. It'll be good." And I thought, all right. You know, it was a Saturday, and so wanted to help my brother out. So I grabbed my gi, went over, and go into this place where he's was taking pictures. I have no idea what I'm doing. Well, it turns out that he was shooting a small Jeff Speakman seminar, and he had reserved me a spot, right? And so I got to tie my belt, with my gi, and jump in line. There wasn't a very big one. There was probably maybe 15, 20 people, and got to train with Jeff Speakman. That was the great part of it. The funny part of it is because I was going to a photo shoot, I didn't bring a cup. And I got pulled up many times as the demonstration dummy at where he was showing techniques. It was fantastic to learn, got to see, he talked about techniques that he did in the movie, but let's just say there was some pain. Anyway, but back to the short answer. Yeah. I want to have that moment and bow with Dan Innocento and have something that he taught me, that he taught us, that I take home forever.
I like it. Very nice, very nice. All right, so that's usually the last question, but we're gonna try and workshop another one here. I think I've sort of kind of did this on another episode before, but we'll see here. Do you have anything, something that is an item of inspiration? So this is, like I said, I'm still trying to kind of formulate how I'm going to work this question, but, something that, motivates you or inspires you. So I'll give an example. This could be, anything, a piece of media, so a movie, a TV show, a song, a book, or just anything, but I'll use this example. The movie Rocky IV, every time I watch that movie, when he has his little, the training montage and the song Hearts of Fire plays, I'm amped up to train. I've watched the movie so many times, there's not a number. I've watched it a pie amount of times. It's continuously increasing number of times. And every time I get to that scene and that song is playing and watching him, running through the snow and chopping the wood and lifting the boulders and everything, I'm ready. It's like, okay, it's time to go to class. It's time to go to sparring. I'm ready to go. So, there's anything that you have that always inspires you. What would that be?
I sure do. I have two of them, but I can narrow it to one. We need the end of Last Samurai. There is the scene where the head general, the samurai, has been killed, and he's presenting the sword to the emperor. And he was asked, you know, Tom Cruise was asked, how did he die? And gets me every time. He says, let me tell you how he lived. And I've those who know me hear me say the quote a lot, that everybody dies, but not everybody lives. And it's not just the living, but how we live. That's such an inspiration. And so I think about that ending scene, and that inspires me to how I train, to how I parent, to how I relate, to how I work, to how I celebrate, even how I mourn. So that's got to be. I know it's just an ending piece. The whole movie is inspirational, but the I hope that when the final chapter of the last, you know, pages is closed for me, that there's something worth saying. Let me tell you how he lived.
I like it. I like it. It's a great answer. I like it. All right. So now we are moving to our shameless self-promotion. So now you can plug anything that you'd like, or if there's anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to make sure we get out there, you have the floor. This is your time, and we'll close out from there.
Oh my, this has got to be the area that I am the the least good at. You know, we are launching, Brittany and I are going to be launching some videos. We've come up with a concept. We call it the Bushido Forge, and that's what we've named our dojo. And taking the principles of the Bushido, right, the way of the warrior, the honor, the respect, the beauty in the art, and as well as the application and the concept of a forge, right? The refining fire, where we forge ourselves into the blades, we forge ourselves into what is strong, what is flexible, what is sharp, and the hammering is in a fun process. So the whole part of bladesmithing, relating that to training, Bushido Forge. We've got some exciting videos that we're going to be releasing. We have some exciting products that we're going to be introducing. And so I would say stand by.
Very nice. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And make sure to any links and things for those, make sure to send them to me, and I'll make sure that they get into the show notes there. But excited for that. All right. Well, yeah, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on and tell me your story. And I'm excited to see what's next for you. And hopefully we can do this again down the road and get into more items and get more specific on topics. But yeah, I just thank you again so much for being on. And I can't wait to get this out for everyone to hear.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, as long as there's people such as yourself who are taking the time to talk and pull in the community and asking these questions, then I think we have it supports our bright future. So I want to thank you for the honor of being on today and us just having a great conversation.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.